From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up on this Wednesday edition, the back and forth continues. It appeared last night that a deal was about to be reached in the Phase 3 coronavirus relief effort known as the CARE Act. But details of the measure appear to be dividing senators. Missouri Senator Josh Hawley is scheduled to check in with us. We'll also check in with Washington Times White House correspondent Dave Boyer on what it now appears Nancy Pelosi may not get in the coronavirus relief bill. And the White House continuing to encourage Americans to be all in the 15 days to slow the spread of the coronavirus, even more so as folks are growing restless, thinking this is much to do about nothing. But they are not seeing what is happening within the hot zones at hospitals in states like California, New York, and now Louisiana. Dr. Catherine O'Neill, infectious disease expert, chief medical officer at Our Lady of the Lake Regional Medical Center in my home city of Baton Rouge, will join us. And the virus is impacting elections. Right now, 12 states have changed their elections, and more disruptions are expected. Brent Kylan, vice president of FRC Action, is here with more. Also, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said this yesterday.
We're not going to accept a premise that human life is disposable.
Does that apply to all human life? We'll talk about it with Travis Weber, vice president of policy here at the Family Research Council. The website, TonyPerkins.com, if you're on Twitter, at T Perkins. All right, the third wave of the coronavirus relief bill, known as the CARE Act, was on a fast track to be approved by the Senate at the end of last week, but it's been derailed by, actually, Nancy Pelosi flew into town to help, and boy, did she help. The thought was maybe last night they had reached consensus, then this morning, then this afternoon, but still, no agreement, no language. When will we see a vote? Well, joining us now to talk more about this, White House correspondent Dave Boyer, who is the Washington Times reporter there at the White House. Dave, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you were writing about how helpful Nancy Pelosi was in terms of what she was trying to attach to the coronavirus relief bill. Things that had nothing to do with what the American people are needing right now as it pertains to the coronavirus.
That's right. She was she came into the middle of the negotiations over the weekend and added a whole bunch of extraneous measures, provisions, including parts of the Green New Deal energy plan that Democrats want to impose on the country, requiring any airline that got government aid to agree to improve their mileage fuel efficiency standards by 2025 and essentially impose a carbon tax on the airlines. She wanted some immigration reforms in there, you know, favorable to the Democratic cause, and so on and so on. And so that set back the negotiations for at least 24, probably 48 hours.
Well, let's talk about that for just a moment. I want people to understand when they put these types of mandates, like a carbon neutral by 2025 for airlines, that just passes the cost along to the consumer. That just drives up the cost because they're going to have to pay the carbon tax. So all of this goes back to the consumer, but they can go back to their base and say, oh, we're addressing global warming.
That's right. And everybody in Congress knows it was a play to her base. And she had no compunction about doing it. I think she honestly realized that the Senate bill was probably going to be the one that ended up being the main vehicle for the relief for the economy. But at the same time, she wanted to, and her troops wanted to, be able to tell their liberal base, environmentalists and so on, that they were fighting for these kind of things in the bill.
Also, $25 million going to the Kennedy Center. I don't know how that fights the coronavirus.
As I understand, that's still in the bill as it stands. Originally it was going to be $35 million, but it's right now I think it is still $25 million.
That's what I was going to ask you. Some of these things are still in the and of course, we haven't seen final language yet because there's apparently some hiccups here that they're trying to work through. But she did get some of this into the bill, did she not?
Yes, she did. She succeeded in some. And in fact, one of the things they're fighting about now and that is still holding up the bill is the what Senator Schumer has referred to as his unemployment on steroids plan, where Republican senators are now objecting, now that they're looking at the language, they're objecting to the fact that under this Democratic proposal to significantly enhance unemployment benefits, some states would end up paying, giving more in unemployment benefits to people than they had earned while holding a real job. So that,
right.
That's
incentivizing,
that's complicating, yeah.
Incentivizing people to leave the workforce when this whole thing is designed to keep people in the workforce so that employers don't have to lay people off. We don't see a drop in or a rise in unemployment. So this is and I know, Dave, you know this on, you know, as you track this stuff, that when you work in haste, there's a reason our government moves slow, doesn't move slow enough sometimes. To look at the unintended consequences. Now, the whistle was blown on this afternoon of this unintended consequence. But the concern is, if they go back under the hood, that they're going to be adding other things to it, that the bill's going to be even worse when it comes out.
That's right. It just keeps growing. And, you know, obviously the Democrats, Pelosi and her troops are seeing this as a grand opportunity. In fact, they even said that before the negotiations really started in earnest, that this is a grand opportunity to get some of the things that they've always wanted that are unrelated to the economic crash, but they could, you know, attach to this package. And I think we've seen that happening.
Now, I certainly appreciate what the administration is trying to do. I mean, I know we're fighting both a health care crisis. I'm going to talk about that in a moment with a medical expert. But we're facing an economic crisis as well. So we're fighting a war on two fronts. So I appreciate that, what the president is doing. But we're talking about a lot of money. And this is over $2 trillion, and it's like somebody just, you know, broke into the bank and giving money away.
And, Tony, the really startling thing to me, not only is it $2 trillion now, but in my conversations with economists and other people today, it's becoming pretty clear that this is not the end of it, that this is just viewed, and Mitch McConnell pretty much said the same thing on the Senate floor today, this is not stimulus for the economy. This is relief to help people get through the next 2 or 3 months. It's not going to do anything for economic growth. We are looking at a pretty bad immediate recession coming, hopefully very brief, but still, you know, very, very sharp downturn in unemployment. I mean, upturn in unemployment. And a lot of people are looking at the need for another package, you know, several months from now to actually get the economy going again.
Yeah, and I know the president's growing restless. I'm sure you've covered this with his comments that he wants to see people get back to work. I mean, he's got to be, and I talked to him on a conference call last Friday, and of course he remains steady, upbeat. But you can tell this is wearing on him. Here's an economy that he helped just skyrocket in terms of lowest unemployment in history, and now it's just kind of just in a couple of weeks imploding.
Yeah, it really is breathtaking, the speed and scope in which this all, you know, came crashing down, if you will. And you know, President Trump is rightfully proud of the economy he built, as you said, or helped to fashion with his low regulations, his regulatory cuts, his tax cuts, and his trade deals that have all been, you know, over the last 3 years, really getting this economy going on the right path. And, you know, you've seen the stock market rise. And then it's just a very shocking thing that, you know, like you said, it had nothing to do with anything the United States had done. But it came from outside our borders. And there's, you know, it's a pandemic. And there's really very little that you can do to completely eliminate it. You just have to hope for the, you know, take the steps that you can and hope for the best and let it run its course. And in the meantime, it's having a really, really brutal effect on the economy.
Well, Dave, it's kind of the way life is, where we don't see these things coming. And it's true in history. that some of the world's greatest leaders, history's greatest leaders, were never, they weren't planning for the things that came upon them, but they led through them. How do you think, as you're there at the White House, as a White House correspondent for Washington Times, how do you see the president dealing with this crisis that no one saw coming?
I think he's handled it very well. I think he's remarkably appearing at the press podium every single day to, I think it helps reassure the nation. It shows that he's in charge. He's there with his advisors, and he's talking, you know, sometimes for 2 hours or more about taking all the questions that he can about what he's doing and how they're trying to beat this down. And he's obviously completely engaged in it, and he's fully, you know, showing that he's in charge. And I think, you know, that you see that in the polls this week that are coming out. I think it's reflected that, you know, people are giving him very high marks. Independents are giving him really, really strong marks on his handling of this.
Yeah, I think he's at his best when he's able to just deal with issues from an impromptu manner. You compare what he's doing now with these press conferences to his Oval Office address, where he was working off the teleprompter, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that those are the words that they all put together, so it's not like he was just reading the words. I know it was his speech,
yeah.
But he is better impromptu because he is a leader and he wants to lead. And I think he's done remarkably well in the midst of this crisis. But we're far from seeing the end of it. And again, it's both a health issue and it's an economic issue. We've got to solve both. We can't deal with one at the detriment of the other. So let me ask you this day before we run out of time. Your sense on the timing of a vote in the Senate, will they get something out in the next 24 hours? And how will the House take it up?
I think in the next 24 hours, yes, the Senate will be done with this. My sense is that Senator Lindsey Graham, Tim Scott, and a few others who have raised these objections about the unemployment insurance are going to somehow be satisfied with some tweaks to the language that will not involve the unraveling of the entire bill. Because now you've got on the other side Senator Bernie Sanders, who of course is still running for president for the Democratic nomination, threatening to blow up the whole bill if the Republicans don't drop their objections to the unemployment insurance provision. So with that hanging over their head, and I have no doubt that Senator Bernie Sanders is serious about that threat, I think they're going to find some kind of language fix to this, and the Senate will pass it in the next 24 hours. Then the House would most likely approve it by the end of the week.
All right. Dave Boyer, thanks so much for taking time to join us this afternoon.
Thanks, Tony.
All right, Dave Boyer, White House correspondent for The Washington Times. We may hear from Senator Hawley later in the program. He's involved in the negotiations over the language. All right, a lot of people anxious to get back to life as normal. They haven't seen the effects of the virus and think it's a lot to do about nothing. But they've not seen behind the doors of the ER rooms that are treating the victims of this virus. We'll be joined by disease expert and chief medical officer of the Lady of the Lake, Dr. Catherine O'Neill, next. Is historic masculinity lost forever? Where can boys, young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of manhood, leadership, and strength in a culture of gender confusion? We need men to be men, tough with compassionate strength, bent toward justice without compromise, locking arms and standing. We need to be the men God created us to be and fight for all that is right, true, and just. This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join us at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference. To find out more, go to standcourageous.com. This conference is led by men who are seasoned, compassionate men who understand the issues of the day and will invest in you, helping you understand your role as a defender, a provider, an instructor, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, so that you can have the generational influence that God has designed you to have. Learn more at standcourageous.com. That's standcourageous.com.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood is the primary supplier of abortions in the U.S.? According to Planned Parenthood's most recent annual report, it committed over 345,000 abortions in fiscal year 2018. That means, on average, Planned Parenthood aborted 1,768 babies every single day in 2018. And while Planned Parenthood's report revealed an increase in abortions committed, many of the services they provide, such as breast exams and cancer screenings, have drastically decreased. FRC recently released its 2020 edition of The Real Planned Parenthood, Leading the Culture of Death. In this resource, you will find many facts revealing the truth, that Planned Parenthood is in the business of abortion, not healthcare. To access this resource and to find out more, go to frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts. That's frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts.
We can all benefit from a good lecture. They inform you and grow you. But sometimes you can't make it in person to every talk, seminar, or lecture you'd like to. Fortunately, Family Research Council now has a new podcast, so you won't miss out. FRC's new weekly podcast, called Lecture Me, was created to help inform and equip listeners on the biggest issues affecting our culture today. Each episode presents a lecture selected from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast features today's top thinkers who address important issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Make sure to stay tuned after each lecture to hear FRC's thoughts on the content as they further discuss the topic at hand. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So good to have you with us. As of yesterday, Louisiana, my home state, has the third highest number of coronavirus cases per capita in the country, behind New York and Washington State. Joining me now from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, is infectious disease expert and chief medical officer of Our Lady of the Lake Regional Medical Center in Baton Rouge is Dr. Catherine O'Neill. Dr. O'Neill, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, thank you for having me.
On Sunday, our governor, John Bel Edward, issued a stay-at-home order effective until April the 13th in an effort to contain the spread of the virus. How did Louisiana become number three in the nation with corona cases?
It's always hard to know exactly how an area gets an influx of cases so quickly. We do know that there are certain things that are accelerators, and there are many hypotheses right now that Mardi Gras was an accelerator. We've definitely went through a mass of lots of big social gatherings in Louisiana, mm-hmm. and also lots of travelers. So people from other countries, people from all over the United States coming to New Orleans especially, which is where we're seeing the most cases, and then going back to their home states. And so that acceleration process has been described before, and I have to believe that Mardi Gras probably played some role in accelerating the case number here.
Well, Dr. O'Neill, I want to address something because so many people are just kind of dismissive of this. The president, the governor asking people to avoid crowds, to not meet in groups of more than 10. And people who are healthy and they haven't seen or heard of anybody who's sick think this is much to do about nothing. But when you go behind the doors of the emergency rooms in the hospitals that are now quarantined, basically, only the patients can come in and the staff, this is serious what's happening. And Louisiana has kind of become an epicenter of this, the spread of the coronavirus. And this is a very, very serious virus.
It absolutely is. Those of us in Baton Rouge have been watching with some trepidation and also preparing our staff and our physicians to be ready for the virus as we've seen our colleagues have to deal with it first in New Orleans. Starting last week, we began to see an influx of cases on our own. And as you said, behind the doors of the hospital where we're trying to keep our staff safe and keep the public safe by not visiting, we are seeing just a huge increase in patients who are coming in with respiratory distress, needing ventilators for respiratory distress. So we're a couple of weeks behind New Orleans, but seeing that same thing that they saw several weeks ago, which is life-threatening illness in people who should not be presenting with such severe disease. It's disturbing to see, and it's exactly what we were told to expect.
And because of the uniqueness of this virus and how it becomes airborne, the aerosolization of what is in the lungs of those that have this, there's only certain treatments for the respiratory challenges, and it's the intubation using the ventilators, and there are only so many of those.
That's right. So the virus starts to multiply in your in the back of your throat, but then it goes down into your lungs and causes a severe pneumonia. When people can't breathe on their own, we're left with just a couple of options. Sometimes you can provide oxygen, and for those people with mild disease, they get through. But many of these patients require time on the ventilator to breathe, and we don't have enough ventilators to take care of all of the patients that we expect to have if we don't stay home and isolate ourselves from our family, from our friends, and especially from large crowds. If we continue to act without social distancing, we are not going to have enough ventilators to treat everybody who's ill.
So that's the point behind this, about the social distancing, the stay-at-home orders, the avoiding of the crowds, is so that our medical personnel are not overrun, our equipment is not all used up to where we can meet those needs. If not, we get into these really difficult decisions of having to ration equipment. So this is all about the well-being of the community and the reason everybody has a part to play in this.
That's right, Tony. One of our doctors here at Our Lady of the Lake, Mark Laperouse, continues to tell his team, it's not about the virus. The virus is a very bad virus, but it's not about the virus. It's about the volume. If we continue to see this increase in volume day after day, we're going to run out of equipment to take care of patients. If we slow the virus down, then we can treat every patient as we would want to treat them according to our standards of care. But if that volume comes at us too quickly, we're going to run out of the supplies we need, including the ventilators we need to care for our family members. And then when they get here, we won't have the tools to help them.
Dr. O'Neill, before we run out of time, very, very quickly, this presents some very significant challenges to the healthcare workers, those frontline personnel that are treating this that are unique. I mean, there's always challenges there, but this is a particularly threatening virus to the healthcare workers. So we need to be mindful of them, and that by doing things that we shouldn't be doing, by going into these crowds, we're not only putting other people at risk, but we're putting our healthcare workers at risk.
Right. So we need all of our healthcare workers because, again, that volume is coming at us, and we need everybody to be able to come to work and be healthy and be able to take care of our patients. And when we put our healthcare workers at risk by interacting with them in the community and possibly being sick during that interaction. Listen, we all still have to go to the grocery store. We all still have to go to the pharmacy. And if you are not feeling well and you are still in the community spreading the virus, you're putting the only people that we have to take care of these patients at risk. So it's all of our responsibility to make sure that we social distance and isolate ourselves.
So that's your final thoughts, recommendation that we do the social distancing, just as the White House has asked, 15 days to slow the spread, a little bit longer maybe for us in Louisiana. But this is kind of a new normal. We've got to keep our distance. We've got to make sure we're, washing our hands, hand sanitizing. If you're ill, by all means, stay at home.
Absolutely. The same tenets that we've been doing, but paying attention to every single aspect of social distancing. And that means talking to somebody on the street, in front of your house, in your neighborhood, stand 6 feet away. Every little bit of distance counts.
But can I give my wife an exception to that?
Maybe, I'll let you have an exception, but make sure that she's well first.
Okay. All right. Dr. O'Neill, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. I appreciate it.
All right. Dr. Catherine O'Neill at Our Lady of the Lake Regional Medical Center in my hometown of Baton Rouge. It is serious, folks. And I'm going to talk about this maybe a little bit later. But I'm really frustrated with now some pastors who are saying they're going to meet regardless. And we're seeing now cases across the country where churches are becoming the epicenters of outbreaks. It's real. and we need to do our part. We can still minister and reach our people and reach the community, but we've got to abide by these guidelines. All right, don't go away. We're coming back with more Washington Watch after this.
What are you reading this spring? At FRCblog.com, we have timely and original commentary on the issues facing our culture today. Our blog is written by our policy experts, the Family Research Council team, and outside contributors. On our blog, you can read about a wide variety of topics, including religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture. Some of our most recent blog posts include, "To abandon the nuclear family ideal is to abandon being human." "Why does the abortion industry hate women?" "China uses coronavirus to oppress religious minorities," and many more. At Family Research Council, our mission is to advance faith, family, and freedom in the culture by helping you to live out your faith and to stand for truth. With our blog, we hope to help you do that. Stay informed and get the resources you need at FRCblog.com. Again, that's FRCblog.com.
The Fairness for All Act was recently introduced to the House of Representatives after the passage of the Equality Act. In response, FRC has come out with a new publication, The Unfairness of the Fairness for All Act. This act attempts to find a compromise between the First Amendment protection of religious freedom and the demands of the LGBT community. Despite having the best intentions, it is an ill-advised and poorly drafted bill that does not achieve its goal. If this act is passed into law, it would allow the federal government to impose a belief system and ideology about sexual behavior and identity on all Americans. The Fairness for All Act would negatively impact religious freedom, true equality, and the privacy and safety of women. To access this resource and to learn more, go to frc.org/fairnessforall. That's frc.org/fairnessforall.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. So glad that you are with us. The website, TonyPerkins.com, has lots of resources there for you at the website. In fact, we've got a resource that's available for churches as we work our way through this present crisis. Resources on what to do and what not to do. Creative ways of doing ministry. Look, we got to think outside the box. In the four walls of the church. There are things that we can continue to do, obviously online messages. I was talking to one pastor today from California who he says it's a little challenging preaching to an empty auditorium because it can't gather. He said, but our reach is exploding. He said, we're getting so much. We get calls. We're now putting regular, daily, almost 24/7 programming on our website. They're being creative and they're ministering to people. There could be an outpouring of God's Spirit at this time, if the church will take the opportunity not to to see this as a threat when governments are saying, look, don't meet. In fact, article today, this is from the Christian Post. I mentioned this, I think I mentioned this yesterday. It was a church in Arkansas where 34 people were infected at a children's program back in March. Now, there wasn't a no-meet order at the time, but it shows how rapidly this would spread. 34 people affected by it. And yesterday, one of the greeters at the church, is Greer's Ferry First Assembly, William Barton, died of the coronavirus. He became the first one from that church that died. The pastor pleading with people. He and his wife both came down with now mild cases, but pleading with people to take this seriously. Quote, he said, this is what the pastor said, Mark Palinsky, said, the intensity of this virus has been underestimated by so many, and I continue to ask that each of you take it very seriously. An act of wisdom and restraint on your part can be the blessing that preserves the health of someone else, end quote. And I know there are some pastors that are, you know, trying to make this an issue of religious freedom, that they're going to meet regardless. That's foolish. That's plain foolish. You're putting people's lives at risk people that you are to shepherd and care for. You're putting them at risk. You're putting our healthcare workers at risk, and it's wrong. All of these orders have deadlines, expiration dates. My home state, it's till the 13th. Yes, I know it incorporates Resurrection Sunday, but you can do other things. You can do a drive-in service. Have them come in the parking lot and broadcast your sermon while everybody's sitting there. You can set up a flatbed trailer and do the music. You can continue your online efforts. You can call people. I mean, you can minister, and we need to do it. As we see increasingly, people are anxious. I've seen where the phone calls to the crisis prevention lines have gone through the roof. People are looking for help. Well, instead of fighting these reasonable restrictions of not to meet, churches should be looking for ways to minister. You know, put out hotlines. You know, have a couple people come to the church and man the phones and put on the on Facebook and on internet that you will you'll take calls. You'll pray for people. Open up prayer lines in your churches. But don't be foolish and act like you're doing something, you know, I don't know. I don't want to get carried away here. But it really angers me that you have pastors acting the fool by saying that they're going to go ahead and have church service, even though the authorities, the civil authorities have said, and they're doing this, by the way, uniformly. If they were just picking on churches, I would be the first in line to say, don't do this. But they're not. They're saying all gatherings of over, right now, 10. I'm sure it's going to be raised or lifted eventually. I mean, it's there is an expiration on this. Look, this is for the health of communities. And pastors, I would encourage you to prayerfully consider obeying the civil authorities and looking for other ways to minister and not be an obstacle to ministry. I mean, again, we've got lots of creative ways that other churches are doing, and a resource page for you. Go to TonyPerkins.com, follow the links over, and it's a great resource. I wasn't planning on talking about that. I wanted to talk about, and we're going to talk about, coming up in this next segment. I'll get it out. Brent Kylan, FRC Action Vice President. We're going to talk about how 12 states already have changed their elections. That's how the virus is impacting elections. More disruptions may come. We're going to talk about that. Also, Governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, talking about how we got to protect life. Joe Biden actually making the same comment. I'm going to be talking with Travis Weber about that as well. And what lines do they draw? Is it all human life that they protect? We're going to talk about that on the other side of the break as well. Again, the website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at T Perkins. Don't go away. We still have lots more Washington Watch to come right after these messages. Where can young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of real manhood, leadership, and strength in today's culture of gender confusion? This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join us at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference led by men who are seasoned, compassionate men who understand the issues of the day and will help you understand your role as a defender, provider, instructor, battle buddy, and chaplain so that you can have the generational influence God has designed you to have. Learn more at StandCourageous.com.
Recently, a bill called the Fairness for All Act was introduced to the House of Representatives. In response, FRC has a new resource, the Unfairness of the Fairness for All Act. This act attempts to find a compromise between the First Amendment's protection of religious freedom and the demands of the LGBT community. But, unfortunately, it is a poorly drafted bill that would negatively impact religious freedom, true equality, and the privacy and safety of women. Learn more at frc.org/fairnessforall.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood is the primary supplier of abortions in the U.S.? According to Planned Parenthood's most recent annual report, it committed over 345,000 abortions in fiscal year 2018. That means, on average, Planned Parenthood aborted 1,768 babies every single day in 2018. And while Planned Parenthood's report revealed an increase in abortions committed, many of the services they provide, such as breast exams and cancer screenings, have drastically decreased. FRC recently released its 2020 edition of The Real Planned Parenthood, Leading the Culture of Death. In this resource, you will find many facts revealing the truth, that Planned Parenthood is in the business of abortion, not healthcare. To access this resource and to find out more, go to frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts. That's frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts.
We can all benefit from a good lecture. They inform you and grow you. But sometimes you can't make it in person to every talk, seminar, or lecture you'd like to. Fortunately, Family Research Council now has a new podcast so you won't miss out. FRC's new weekly podcast, called Lecture Me, was created to help inform and equip listeners on the biggest issues affecting our culture today. Each episode presents a lecture selected from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast features today's top thinkers who address important issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Make sure to stay tuned after each lecture to hear FRC's thoughts on the content as they further discuss the topic at hand. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us on this Wednesday afternoon. The website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, everything coronavirus, but there's a lot of stuff still happening. I mean, this comes right in the middle of election season. With all the quarantine time people are using to catch up on hobbies and exercise, maybe taking a few minutes, they ought to take a little few minutes to kind of learn about the issues, about the candidates, because even though some of these elections have been postponed, they will come around. Joining me now to talk more about this is Vice President of FRC Action, Brent Kylan, with a breakdown of those states that have changed their election dates, as well as the iVoter Guide, which is a resource you can use. Brent, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks, Tony. Good to be with you.
All right, let's start first with those states and territories that have changed their elections.
Absolutely. So we're up to, as you mentioned earlier, 12 states plus some territories that have changed their elections already. And I'll say, Tony, this is changing by the day. We're closely monitoring this. To give a little background here, we've had 23 states at this point, and Washington, D.C., and a few territories that have not had their presidential primary vote so far. And then on top of that, where, you know, obviously the presidential contests have received most of the national attention so far, there are 42 states that have not yet had congressional primaries. So the vast majority of states have not had that level of races. So a lot of states have moved those thus far. We have a couple of states that are even this week. The legislatures are convening, states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, meeting this week to move those primaries.
So what's going to be the effect of this? Because, I mean, you know, we just it not only affects the people who vote, but, I mean, this affects campaigns and candidates. I mean, this has a ripple effect.
You know, it really does, Tony. A lot of these campaigns are kind of at a standstill. They can't go door to door. obviously can't do outreach like that, but they also don't have a election date to shoot for. So their whole campaign strategy built on that end goal is kind of up in the air right now. And then tactics are changing. If you look at, for example, the special election in California's 25th district, that's on May 12th. It's been moved to a completely mail-in ballot election per Friday executive order from Governor Newsom out there. So different tactics like that as well. And then what's going to happen to turnout? That's the other question a lot of these campaigns are asking, because, you know, once voters get one day in their mind, if that changes once, if that even changes a couple times, that really can disrupt how many people are coming out and voting and participating in that.
And it's challenging for the campaigns, too. You know, speaking as one who's been involved in a number of campaigns and been a candidate, is that when you shrink or condense the time between the primary and the general election, you have less time to raise money, less time to reach people. So the primaries, especially if you've got a very competitive primary, that could make, that really could tilt the outcome of the general, because if it's then a competitive general election, but not a lot of time to rebuild the war chest, and if one side, the Republican or the Democrat, has a competitive and tough primary, it's going to give an advantage to the other in the general.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, a lot of stories even right now being written on how this is changing how campaigns fundraise, how they do really just about everything. And as you alluded to right there, the further that primary date gets bumped, and then, you know, some of these even have a runoff after that on top of it if they don't clear the threshold. If they're running against a candidate with a lot of name ID already, that gives them a much smaller window to build their own name ID with the district, right, and also a shorter amount of time to build those campaign coffers back up.
Yeah, and at a time like this, you really can't campaign. I mean, nobody's paying attention to it, and it's seen, you're seen as tone deaf if you're out there talking about things when people are focused on this crisis in front of us. So it does make it difficult. Let's talk about a resource that is available for people that do have elections coming up. It's something that actually in the primaries that did take place was heavily utilized, and it's the iVoter Guide.
Yeah, that's right, Tony. This is a tool we have been working on with a number of groups. You can find iVoter Guide on our website, frcaction.org, and then you can either access it via the homepage there or look under the Voting Resources tab. But we are working to provide this along with these other groups. It really gives you information on the candidates as well as some of the essential voter information out there. You know, as these election dates get changed, we are trying to track that, post that. Again, that's proven a tricky task to stay on top of, but we're working to do that as some of these dates are changing by the day. But in all of the federal Republican primaries, if there's a competitive federal Republican primary in your state, we're going to cover that so you can look and find information on all those candidates in that guide. And then some state-level races as well, such as governor, state representatives, depending on the state, and then moving into the fall, we'll be covering all those races as well. But it covers things like primary dates, again, if that gets moved, when the voter registration deadlines are. That's very important. And then we get a lot of requests on other types of information, such as how do I register to vote? How do I check my voter registration status? How do I find my district? So you can find all of those right there. It's kind of a one-stop shop. And obviously, this is all online. So even with the social distancing right now, this is something you can access and something you can even share with other people.
All right. Brent Kylan, thanks so much for joining us. Folks, that's the iVoter Guide. Make a resource out, a very good resource for you. Brent, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tony. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the new terms that we now have, social distancing. Wow. All right. Democrats like New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and presidential candidate Joe Biden are standing for the lives of those most at risk of COVID-19. But there's a limit to those lives that they'll defend. Joining me now to talk more about this, Vice President of Policy here at the Family Research Council, Travis Weber. Travis, welcome.
Thank you, Tony.
Thanks for being patient there and standing by. Let me play a clip of Governor Andrew Cuomo yesterday. This was responding. In fact, we talked about this on the radio. We talked about the lieutenant governor of Texas making a comment about, look, let's get on with our lives. If you know, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but it was kind of like, if I die as over 70, you know, I don't mind. I want the economy to keep moving. I don't agree with what he said or the way it came across. But Governor Cuomo was asked about it, and this is what he said.
My mother is not expendable, and your mother is not expendable, and our brothers and sisters are not expendable, and we're not going to accept a premise that human life is disposable, and we're not going to put a dollar figure on human life.
So has he had a change of heart? Is this not the same governor who celebrated when the legislature there in New York passed legislation allowing a baby to be aborted all the way up to the day of birth, and then, if they survived an abortion, let them die?
Tony, this, I think, you know, among other things, the circumstances right now are shining a huge light on the gruesome realities of abortion and the horrific special treatment that its advocates demand. And Governor Cuomo, to be consistent, he does have to change his position on abortion. He does need to account for the position celebrating abortion, which you have just referenced, that he's taken in the past, because what he's saying now about the value of human life, we would agree with. But right, that needs to be applied consistently across the board. And you can't say, well, let's treat those who need treatment, obviously, now, which we agree with, and a lot of people are focused on. But you can't say we're going to elevate that because of the human dignity of these people, and then at the same time stand by while those in the womb and the unborn continue to go to their death.
He wasn't the only one. Joe Biden also making a comment about this yesterday from his home studio. Bobby, do we have clip number three?
My principal focus today and every day will be on what we should do to get this response fixed to save lives.
I mean, he wants to, I don't know if that was the whole clip or we got the whole, yeah, anyway, he was very similar comment. Maybe I got the wrong clip there, but wants to save lives. But yet here is a candidate representing a party that not only wants to allow babies to be aborted up to the day of birth, and then, as I mentioned earlier, allow them to die if they survived an abortion attempt, but he is also now on record wanting to make Americans pay for that, you and me, to pay for that.
Tony, as you know, one of the things we've been trying to stay on top of here is our attempts by abortion advocates to capitalize on this crisis to try to push their ideological wish list through the policy process. We know that in versions of the coronavirus relief bills, which has been passing through Congress, that Speaker Pelosi tried to open up that the gap for funding to not be subject to the Hyde restriction, which prevents taxpayer dollars from funding abortion, what you just referenced. The Democrat Party is moving in the direction of trying to not just expand and legalize abortion, but get us all to pay for it. If nothing else, I mean, we've been advocating for the protection of the unborn for years, but if nothing else, everyone needs to now just pause and look at the crisis on hand. Meanwhile, we've got abortion advocates unwilling to do that, wanting to jam through their demands for special protection. I mean, I'm looking at a list of states now. We're seeing this grow around the country who are declaring abortion to be essential care. Just think about this. Essential care, necessary care, when you've got questions being raised about, are we going to have enough hospital beds, ventilators, treatments, gloves, medical workers to care for those facing death from the coronavirus. And if you've got people still showing up and saying abortion is essential and we can't stop abortions right now.
Yeah, and the reason, I talked about this actually in an interview earlier today, the abortion clinics are under, in most cases, in most states, they're regulated just like other outpatient surgery centers, ambulatory surgical centers, because they do outpatient surgery. So they're treated that way. The reason that the surgery centers are closed down now is because if they have complications, They then have to take them to the emergency rooms, where two things can happen. One, they now expose someone else potentially to the coronavirus, because almost now everyone who goes into an ER room is going to have to be quarantined for 2 weeks, self-quarantined, because whether they, if they didn't have it, they may have it. And then secondly, if it's a very serious case going into the emergency room, they're going to end up utilizing necessary limited equipment to treat those with the coronavirus, like the as we were talking about, the ventilators. So that's the reason that they have done this. And of course, abortion is not essential health care. And thankfully, Ohio, Texas, Louisiana, some other states, Mississippi have recognized that. And it's, and it is, again, putting people's lives at risk. Before we move on to some of the other things happening on that, I do want to mention this from a standpoint of this idea that, you know, old people don't have as much value or young people don't have as much value, that we're saying it's all human life. It doesn't matter whether you're old or young, born or unborn. That shouldn't determine whether you're worth more or less. A person matters not because of the value they bring to the rest of society, but because they have inherent value because they're created in the image of God. And that's how we have to approach this issue of life and the treatment of those who need help.
Tony, that's fully correct. And as you know, we advocate for the protection of the unborn because it's part of how we view human life from the Christian ethic, which you've just referenced, protecting everyone from the unborn until the elderly who until they die a natural death, protecting, caring for them in their old age, and guarding against physician assisted suicide and other infringements on that view. This is how we left to look at all life, and the unborn are part of that. And we should not, no one should be standing by and saying, well, we need to carve out exemptions for abortion right now. We're dealing with this national emergency, and every effort is being made to care for those who are in need.
But we, when we talk about this issue of the political parties and where they stand on abortion, I mean, there has never been a clear contrast between the two parties. You know, we've got a president and the Republican Party doing everything he can to advance human life, and then we have the other side where, again, abortion up to the day of birth. I mean, there is a real clear contrast.
Well, and we have been compiling a record of what President Trump's done on this, the administration accomplishments, which are available on our website, on the questions of life, family, and religious freedom. And he has a stellar record on life. A number of steps that this administration has taken to protect the unborn, protect human life. You know, and this is, I mean, look, just going back to our previous discussion, right now we've got every effort focused nationally. We're hearing President Trump calling on companies to help chip in, contribute to the effort to get masks, gloves, and other equipment to hospitals. You know, this is the pro-life ethic is consistent with, frankly, the administration's not just their policies, but their efforts right now to ensure that those in the hospitals are in need of protection, who are in need of protection, get it. We can't be stopping and diverting that away because of the abortion lobby right now. And this is consistent with, you know, what we've advocated for years.
All right. Travis Weber, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
And folks, resources at TonyPerkins.com, and do your part. 15 days to slow the spread. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.